Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
And a welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you're with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, George P. Fraser. George is a man who plays below average golf, but you know what? Below average is awfully close to average.
Thank you.
You look at it that way, that's kind of positive.
Yeah.
I'm always trying to be optimistic.
I'm thinking my lifespan below average, Bill. But you know, it's
you get
not
to
over.
Decide that.
No, it's not over yet.
I think
it's
your
not.
Best years are ahead.
I don't.
Don't you?
No.
You think they're behind? Why would you say that?
My memory's so bad, I could have done something great and I remembered it.
Well, and when you were nine, you won the punt, passing, kick competition in Edina, which is no slouch.
You know,
you must have been a good little kid. I mean,
I wasn't a good little kid. I was a good athlete 54 years ago, you know, and I hardly remember it except only thing I ever did.
Mm-hmm. So your life peaked when you were nine.
Peaked a little early. Gene Purdy was still living in Oklahoma, or that never would have happened.
That's so true.
That is true.
Yeah.
We speak the truth.
Our nemesis.
So enough about me. Why don't you talk about me for a while, and then we'll get back to me.
Yeah. Well, George, tonight on Real Recovery, we're going to talk about people who are, living with someone with an active addiction. And, 95% of alcoholics and drug users have families, jobs, and friends. And that they may function well or not, but their drinking is causing, or their drug using is causing, a huge problem in the lives of the people that they're with.
Well, many times the job's going to be the last to go. I mean, you can get another family, but getting a job's tough, and you need money to keep drinking and to keep using, seriously. Mm-hmm. And you can have all kind of excuses in your mind about how these people don't deserve you or whatever, but you need a job, and you need money to use, and you really need your family, too. But when you're that deluded, you really don't think that. People don't respect me. They don't treat me the way I deserved. I'm out busting every day, and they're nagging me. Nag.
Yeah.
And it's a mess.
Well, if you're, in a relationship with somebody that's using, and you're suffering, and you're feeling isolated, and you're feeling misunderstood, and you're feeling lonely, and you're feeling that there's no intimacy in your life, and yet God is there for you, and yet you're still feeling displaced, you're displaced for a good reason.
It's not working.
Yeah, it's not working.
It's not working on any levels. Where is God in this? What's my piece? What do I do? Where this comes up most often, Bill, and you know this because we work with the same people, that parents nowadays, the tough love. Do you kick your kid out on the street? And people always ask me when it comes up and I'm working with them, should I kick my kids out on the street? And I go, well, you can do that. You can use the tough love approach. But a lot of times, really, what it gets down to, and I don't mean to be offensive with this, but do you want your kid dying on the street or in your basement? Hmm. And what can you live with, worst case scenario? Because really, very little that we do, in my opinion, affects another person. You can keep them so they can do it, but they've got to do the work themselves. And that's hard. And I think what we're going to hear tonight is you can, go through all sorts of activities and covering for people and helping them. But until they make up their mind they want to do something, it's not going to change.
Mm-hmm. And there is a way to kind of do a diagnosis is if you're a good candidate for a recovery group like an Al-Anon or a support group.
Okay.
For people who are suffering. And if you are, if you're always fearing criticism or you're always overextending yourself, you're making up excuses for somebody, maybe you're just really so uneasy all the time and you're filled with, problems that you can't solve. Now, I know problems, everyone's got problems, but
sure.
What the alcoholic or the drug addict is creating problems, and you're trying to solve them. You're trying to control them. You're trying to figure out how I can care for this person.
Well, and you do care for the person. You probably love the person.
Mm-hmm. You just can't confuse pity with love.
Well, and watching somebody kill themselves is not pleasant. And obviously you want to do something. And tonight we're going to talk to somebody who knows a lot of people that can help you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing that I see, one of the common factors between addiction and people that are codependent is you get to a point where what you're doing is not working and you're stuck and you lose hope. And what we want to talk about tonight is there's a lot of hope and there's a lot of people that are doing this, Christians, and it's helped them tremendously, and then they can help other people.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not stuck. There is hope.
And if you grew up in a family that had drinking in it, and you wonder if that affected you, the answer is probably yes. And it's interesting, George, that the things you suffer as a younger person surfaces in adult life, whether you know it or not.
Why are you looking at me like that for? Like I don't know it. Like I'm the one guy, you know, that says, hey, there's something seriously wrong with me. Most of it's my own doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think until you get to that point where what you're doing and how you're feeling and how you're living isn't normal and there's a better way, I think over the years, Bill, we just get beaten down sometimes and this is as good as it's going to get. And I can't do anything about this. I'm stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight we have some good news for you.
I agree. And if you're finding yourself isolating yourself from other people, maybe you're covering for behavior that you're afraid, you are fearing criticism, you're feeling like you're not being listened to, and there's been a loss of intimacy, it sounds like the need for a support group so you can have healthier boundaries and better understand what's happening in your household would be very useful. Now, there's going to be some people, George, that go, can't I just get that at church? What's your answer?
Well, you can. I always go back to, is church designed for that? I go to church to learn about God, to worship God, and to be in community. And a lot of the churches I've gone to, the people that are there at that place don't seem to be open to sharing about themselves on that level. It's kind of an outside issue in the churches I've gone to. You know what I'm saying, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
And what I always want to do I think it's appropriate? Yeah, I think it is in churches that they have Celebrate Recovery. I know a lot of the recovery meetings meet in churches.
Mm-hmm.
They're not part of the church, but the church in their wisdom lets them meet there. But you can look on the internet on recovery groups and friends of family groups, and you can find people that have a lot in common with you. I always think, Bill, like with golf, for example, if somebody wants to get better, find somebody who plays better and ask them to help you.
Now, in your case, that doesn't narrow the field much, does it?
There's a lot of people, and that's not working, and I'm very sensitive about that, and that I'm stuck on. But as far as relationships and working with people, and if you're in recovery, you know that what I'm going to tell you is true. We never stop pressing on towards the goal, as Paul wrote in Philippians, to be more Christ-like. And as you get sober or you get into friends or family group, you start peeling back the onion. And I know for me in my recovery, I thought when I quit using, I'll be okay. Well, 30-some years later, I'm far from okay. You know, Jesus tells us in the book, if we believe it and act on it, apart from me, you can do what?
Nothing.
Nothing. So all the recovery is getting yourself out of the way so you can get filled with the Holy Spirit and Christ and follow His way. But a lot of us have to go to outside meetings, and gatherings to get that.
Maybe another question, George, would be, do you find it difficult to care for yourself because you're in a relationship with someone who's actively using? And if you are having trouble taking care of yourself or trying to care for others, you know, you might be in that very difficult situation where this is the kind of help that would be greatly beneficial.
Absolutely. I think there's an illusion that we all have that we have a lot more control over life than we do. And one of the sayings that I used to hate that I come to, you know, realize there's a lot of wisdom is to let go and let God. And what that means is to let go of the outcomes. Yeah, we're responsible for the effort. But you can't control what somebody else is going to do. Heck, I can't control what I'm going to do. And even the Apostle Paul, Bill, I think, is saying that in Romans 7. Fair?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know that the stakes are high and you're probably in a scared position, even though you're trusting God through all of this. You still fear an outcome, a negative outcome, and that's no fun to be in that place. So George and I just are encouraging you tonight to be open to community, to find a support group, to find people you can talk to who can say, I've been through that same situation. And it's going to feel refreshing to know that someone else understands and cares about you.
Well, and the good news is there are people out there to help you. The bad news is you have to do something. You have to pick up the phone and call somebody, and you probably have to get in your car and drive somewhere and get out of your car again and walk in.
Say that nicer.
No, I'm not going to, because that's the truth. And I know for me, the reason I'm saying it that way, that was like climbing Mount Everest, right?
Okay.
You know, you have to get over the unwillingness mountain that you're going to go. You know, like you have to get by Wallet Mountain when we go out to eat to get that thing out.
I can't.
That's what you got to do.
Yeah.
And you really have to get into action. And what you realize when you look back in the rearview mirror, why did I wait so long for that? It's not that hard to do. We get in our cars every day and go to the store or go somewhere, go to work. You can do this. And I think the enemy kind of gets us to where we're paralyzed, Bill, and says no. And I think as a Christian, what we got to do is say, hey, I've got God living in me, changing my desires. My job is to pick up that cross, deny myself, and go to that. Give it a shot. You know, they always say, we'll refund your misery if you don't like it.
Is that one of their catchphrases?
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Aimed at me.
Yeah.
I still don't like it. It's true. I took steps that I didn't think would work, and I got results that I can't deny.
Mm-hmm. Well, alcoholism or drug use is certainly a family disease, and if you're in a family and that's suffering from that, you understand exactly what we're talking about tonight. So we hope we can be helpful.
And encouraging.
And encouraging. And we want to just be loving tonight with you and gentle and help you along. I think our guest will do a terrific job of setting an example and letting others know that it's a great step forward and it's going to pay off in a great way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said.
Yeah. So this is Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're going to take a little break, but I promise we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with our special guest tonight, Alexa. Welcome back to the show. So glad you can join us tonight on Real Recovery. Bill Arnold once again on this side of the studio and just across the way, George P. Fraser, a man who taught me that if at first you don't succeed, destroy all the evidence you tried.
Absolutely,
that's
Bill.
That's wonderful wisdom, and I use this to this day.
Yep. Deny it and don't have any evidence.
Thank you. The master of it. George, we've got a great show tonight, and there's been so many people that have written the show, and they've inquired about support meetings. It's an interesting time with COVID-19. More people stuck in their house. They're depressed. They're doing all kinds of semi-medication destructive behaviors, and there's people living with them, and they're suffering too.
Sure. It's a tough time for all of us, and the longer it goes on, I think the harder it gets. I was pretty willing to do this stuff at the beginning. And it's kind of like when I'd keep relapse, and the longer it goes, the less willing I am to put the mask on, the gloves, that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. I think most people are like that. And what we have to do is keep our, you know, our foundation strong, fundamentals. And we always talk about that. And for everybody who's in a recovery, community is vital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're going to show a lot of support for people who might be right now living with someone who has an addiction, and you're maybe losing a little bit of your mind, which is pretty typical. And here to talk about that aspect of it is our guest, Alexa. Alexa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you've been involved in Al-Anon for years and years, haven't you?
I have.
All right. So I'm real curious again, just tell our listeners how you came about getting involved in Al-Anon.
I had grown up in church and took a hiatus when I was a little bit younger because I was contending with the effects of someone's substance use on my life. And I was going a little bit at a time because I was triggered by what it was that I was hearing in church. I was feeling like I was so far from, God in my life because of this alcoholism that was impacting me. And it was just a simple invitation. Someone had said, hey, you know, I think that you should maybe try this. A friend of mine has done it, and I think it may benefit you. And about 9 months later or so, I walked into my first meeting.
Did you feel like, I'm going to be exposing myself? I'm going to be showing the world that I'm in a relationship with someone that is using alcohol, and now there's no turning back?
No, I didn't feel that way whatsoever. I trusted that when I was told things were confidential and that the anonymity of the alcoholic in my life was protected as well as my own, I believed that. Mm-hmm. And that's remained true, I mean, from the time I started until now, which has been years ago at this point. And to be honest, it was a relief to walk into a room and to find other people who were telling my story with the same feelings and the same kinds of thoughts, but different details. They were coming from a different context, and yet the most important parts were exactly the same.
You know, it's interesting. You said it only took you 9 months to get there. What were you thinking? Because I know that's not uncommon. What were some of the thoughts and maybe fears you had about acting on that?
Well, when a friend first suggested that I go, I was confused because I was talking to her about certain problems that I had in the relationship with the person that has qualified me to Al-Anon. And when Al-Anon was suggested to me, or really just the entire idea of recovery to begin with, I was actually a little bit offended. I thought, well, how is working on this particular relationship, you know, with this person going to help me in other areas of my life? And of course, that was a concern. And, you know, this person had the intuition to know that there were deeper issues than what was going on with just this one particular relationship, and that some of my struggles were generalized, you know, to other areas of my life. So to answer your question, I think it was, I don't know that I was desperate enough. I think I needed to go through, you know, several more months of really hitting my own rock bottom with the emotional impact of living with active addiction. And I just came to a point where I woke up one day and thought, I need to do something, because whatever it was that I am doing has provided, some relief, but it's limited. And I've never heard of this. I have no idea what this means, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. And I hopped on the internet and found a meeting and was there probably just a couple hours later.
I would think, Bill, that that's not uncommon in that, what do you mean my problem? If the problem is that person's using, and if they'd stop doing that, I'd be great.
Exactly. And I came to realize that, you know, addiction is a family illness. And one of my aha moments was to recognize that if the substance user, you know, is in the home and suffering, that the family members are also probably suffering. And I knew it. I knew it on, you know, a really deep, like, guttural level that there was something really wrong, you know, in my family. And yet I needed to come to a place where there were others who lived through what I did to put words to my experiences. I didn't know that I was really that lonely. I didn't know that I was struggling with powerlessness. I didn't know that fear was what drove my life. You know, I didn't even know that I was really out of touch with God. And like I had said earlier, I had had some religious experiences in evangelical Christianity where I had, felt God's presence and was open to his guidance, even as a very little girl. I remember that. And it was so distorted, you know, through the later years of my adolescence and into my young adulthood because of all the blocks that I think were there to really having like a living, breathing, working faith.
Oh, that's a lot of honesty. I appreciate that very much. So when you get into a support group meeting, I'm curious as to the way in which you feel comfortable, the interaction, the reciprocation, because I want to let listeners know that if you do go and you have the courage to go, which is great, what to expect.
I walked in and I remember they were so friendly. Everyone was smiling and very compassionate. I mean, they say in recovery that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. And on that day, I was the newcomer. And the kind of hospitality that I experienced was unforgettable. Mm. People were very loving and very open to listen to my pain. And that was something that I definitely found in wonderfully supportive friends, pastors, mentors from my church community. And you know, I think being able to be as honest as I was and still receive that same level of understanding was huge for me. And there's really no judgment. I mean, everyone really keeps the focus on themselves and the ways that they've been impacted. I hear people talk about encouraging and understanding other relatives of those who struggle with substance abuse and extending that same compassion to the user themselves.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, if everybody keeps their focus on themselves, that'd be a natural for me, right? I would think for a lot of people going to that first gathering, how weird are these people going to be? And what's this going to be like? And you got to be pretty desperate to take that risk. I know for me, the first recovery gathering I went to, people were so nice to me. I wondered what their angle was because everybody in my life had an angle. I certainly did. And people just being nice unconditionally for a lot of us is the first time. And I know for me, that was the first time in my life with those people where I could be myself. There weren't any expectations. There weren't really any requirements, you know, other than a desire to not drink anymore and be open and honest. And I had never experienced that anywhere, especially in church. Gosh, I couldn't be honest. Could you?
I could, but I think that that kind of became an empty well for me because of the fact that there were those who were so helpful and trying to be helpful and knew me and loved me, but their experience only went so far and they could only relate to a certain extent. And so, you know, I remember feeling like I was helped by certain individuals, and then there just came a point where it wasn't really enough, and I needed others around me who not only had gone through the experiences that I had gone through themselves, but had come out on the other side, and that was pretty difficult to find.
I love that. It makes a lot of sense, Bill, that somebody who's had success in this area might be a good person to ask and hang around. But it takes a while to get through. I appreciate your honesty on taking 9 months.
Yeah. Let's take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George, we've got Nat on the board tonight. We'll be back in just a minute. Back to the show. I'm so glad you're joining us tonight, and thank you for listening to Real Recovery. George and I are now in our, what, ninth year?
Going into nine.
No, we're in nine, George. We're not
are
going
we?
Into nine.
Okay.
Do you not get any of the memos I send you?
No, I don't read them. I get them.
You should start reading them.
You know.
That would be helpful.
That's interesting. Remember we had 8 weeks? I thought we might get canned after three.
Yeah, we might have eight left after this if you don't start reading my memos.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we have a great show. We have Alexa with us in studio, and we're talking about if you are on the other side of an addiction and you're living in an environment with someone who is actively using, and I and George knows exactly how frustrating that can be and how challenging it can be, and you need to take a step of courage to help yourself. Fair enough,
absolutely,
George?
Absolutely. Yeah, well said.
Yeah. So, Alexa, let me get back to recovery meetings and also the difference between a recovery meeting and just being in church. Do you feel as comfortable talking so openly in your church, or do you think, I'll save those remarks for my recovery meeting where I can be really raw?
I think that it's a both and for me.
Okay.
I need both
okay.
To develop and maintain, you know, my spirituality. I think that in my recovery meetings, I would speak a little bit more specifically. I mean, it's intended to share generally kind of in a meeting and really up close and personal with a sponsor, for instance, or what I call a buddy, which is another person in recovery who has been doing the deal for a while and can help me apply the principles of recovery like honesty, openness, willingness, and those kinds of things to my own situation. I think if I were in church, and it happens pretty frequently when discussions of family or even my own interests and passions, which definitely would be to help others understand the family illness of addiction and how to recover from it, I would share kind of the benefits of my experiences in recovery
mm-hmm.
and speak not in a way that focuses so much on the pain. That's important. But instead focuses more on the solution. How have I been a part of the solution? You know, I was lonely and frustrated and powerless. And through doing the work that was suggested to me, I'm not there anymore.
Fantastic.
And this is how.
Mm-hmm. George, I think it was Glenn Pickering, one of our early guests, who was talking about intimacy and said that's in to see me. And when you have intimacy, you're letting someone else in. And when you're in a relationship with someone who's using, there's usually an intimacy problem, isn't there?
There is.
Mm-hmm. And you start to suffer almost traumatically because there's so many longings that aren't being met.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It comes in so many, you know, different shapes and sizes. I think, first of all, addiction is a problem in relationships. I think it's a disease of many losses. And when you're in a relationship with someone who's actively using, who is probably pretty self-centered as a result of their illness, you know, they're not thinking about the disappointments that they're a part of in others' lives because of their broken promises and lies and secret keeping and really just this superficial way of kind of approaching life. And in addition to that, I mean, the unmet need and the longing, like you said, that was for real connection and knowing of one another. And you know, the rules in the alcoholic system I grew up in were don't talk, don't trust, don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. There's no way that intimacy would have been bred in that kind of environment.
How do you shake that? I mean, to go as a functioning adult, when your thoughts are don't talk, don't feel, don't
trust.
Trust, yeah. That makes it real hard to have an adult relationship.
Most definitely mm-hmm. It can. Even when you're an adolescent or a teenager, right. A young adult, I mean, regardless of whatever stage of life you're in, I'd even make a case for children, you know, who are suffering because of the kind of distance in the relationship. And to answer your question, I think that it comes in a couple different ways, the recovery from that problem. It's kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion. You do it a little bit at a mm-hmm. time. And I did it with a lot of support from other buddies in the program, as well as a few different sponsors over my time in recovery. And what I was shown in those relationships was, oh, I can trust this person. Oh, they are going to follow through on what they say they're going to do. They do have my best interests in heart. I'm going to tell them my secrets and they're not going to judge me or criticize me. And I learned a little bit at a time by experiencing relationships with those who were really grounded, who knew themselves well, and really who could say sorry. Mm. And that wasn't something that I had experienced. And so it happened gradually over time. And then I got to a point where I could put those behaviors into practice too.
George, that's a very interesting point you made about saying sorry.
And you bring that up because
I'm looking at you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying.
Well, I'm not.
When,
with you.
I know you're not with me, but to be, you know, in a relationship where someone's hurting and you've probably hurt them through your addiction.
Sure.
And to not say you're sorry is even making things worse.
You know, it's interesting to hear that because usually what I hear and people I've been involved with, they're real good at saying they're sorry. They're just not real good at not doing it anymore. But something you said that I really want to tie into here. We come in to recovery out of a desperation to avoid pain. But you talked about the willingness, and when it starts working and you start getting the good stuff, you trust people, they trust you, and you feel like you want to open up more and more. I think, Bill, what's really, really important is getting past the desperation stage and getting some return on the investment of what you're doing. That, to me, is where the real growth comes in, when you go, hey, you know what? This is actually working. I want to do it some more. And I find that in my faith, too, that, okay, I'm forgiven of sins. Good, I got that one off the table. But when I actually learn more about Christ, I want to learn more about him and act more like that. And, Bill, it works that way in recovery, too.
It's real interesting, George, even from you.
Are you sorry you said that?
No.
Not at all. But you know what I mean? You know, we are really good at doing stuff where we're going to get an outcome that we desire.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard part about recovery is really letting go and going in with both feet. But when you do that, you're going to get a good return. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
You know, I've heard these expressions before, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but the don't promise, just prove. And don't say, just show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of the trust building, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So much is relearned through your actions, and I'm learning from others, you know, from the actions of others as well.
Has it helped you a lot in your recovery, in your walk, that you can actually be helpful to other people?
Most definitely. I mean, there's a kind of an age-old concept in recovery that in order to keep it, you have to give it away, which is parallel to what scripture says about the life of faith as well. And so much of my growth in recovery has come from sharing my story of what happened and how I began to recover with other people. Sometimes that's as simple as walking up to a newcomer in a meeting, warmly introducing myself and saying, hey, I heard what you said, you know, when I was there too. Other times it's when I've been approached to sponsor other women and can use my experience, strength, and hope and shepherd them kind of through their own working of the 12 steps. And I think the most fun are just strangers that I meet, you know, people on airplanes or at a waitress at a restaurant, others I happen to be, you know, in a class with at some point in time, and they start talking about, you know, different struggles that they have, and I've learned, you know, to listen more than I speak in those kinds of situations. And if I am going to bring up my involvement in 12-step meetings or recovery in general, I'm going to say something like, hey, have you ever heard of Al-Anon? You know, maybe it would be helpful for you. Or I have been through some really similar things. If you would like to learn what I have gleaned from trying to recover myself, you know, please be in touch, and giving that person the chance to have the dignity of making their own choice to get better and to seek that help out, which is very different, I think, than kind of promoting my experience in recovery. It's sort of like an underground community, you know, if you will, that sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then when someone's ready and willing, I mean, they know that they can give me a call.
I love that. You know, Bill, I never had anybody come up to me when I was in a bar and go, hey, man, can I get your phone number? I love the way you fall off your bar stool. You know, that could really be helpful in my life.
I'm trying not to laugh.
Yeah. Like, you know, something I did well. Yeah. But that is true. And what we talk about on Real Recovery, that God doesn't save us from our addiction without having a job for us to do. And if you're listening tonight and you're looking to get sober, or somebody you're with is causing some problems in your life and you need to look at that yourself, here's the best part. God will not only help you with that, but he has a job for you to do.
That's exciting.
To help other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of us, the first time we really felt we had a purpose is when God started changing us in our recovery. Mm-hmm. Fair?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Alexa, talk about the loneliness and isolation part when you're out of community. Because when you would say to someone at a meeting, I heard what you said, I was there myself, that would be pure oxygen to somebody, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Like, oh, somebody gets me, understand me.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about how difficult it is to be outside of community.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was living with active alcoholism, I think that I was living with others and still felt so alone. Mm-hmm. And that was very confusing for me. How could I have, you know, people around me who are my family, who are supposed to be giving me the care and the attention that I had wanted and not receiving it? And so I ended up becoming kind of an expert isolator. And I, even as a little girl, would just make my room my sanctuary, and I would read and listen to music, and I developed a love of music, actually, from spending so much time on my own, most of the time just trying to protect my own emotional well-being. And so when I got into Al-Anon, one of the things I heard was, we too were lonely and frustrated. And it was oxygen, as you said. That's the perfect way to describe it, because I didn't know that there were others in the world who felt as lonely as I did. And even when I would make attempts to try to build connection, I had often felt some shame and some rejection and those kinds of things. And that really scared me off. And so I knew that that was something I needed, that I actually believed God wanted for me also. And that I had in doses. But it wasn't until, you know, I started to really share what was going on that I could build more authentic connections and feel that loneliness sort of slip away.
Wow. That's a very strong testimony.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If people don't treat you right, wouldn't you want to be alone?
Totally. Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And if you feel a little bit misunderstood or left behind, or I can't believe people don't get what I'm going through, yeah, I think the tendency would be to withdraw.
How about safe?
Or you can't get hurt. It's safe. It's self-preservation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George will be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. So glad you are with us tonight. I hope you are getting lots of encouragement tonight. We have a guest, Alexa, who is really dishing it out, giving a lot of encouragement if you're living in an environment where there's an active user and you feel a little bit isolated and alone, misunderstood. It's a great, great encouragement, George.
Well, I think you start questioning your own sanity, don't you? Something's, you know.
What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you start doing basic self-preservation, don't you?
You do, because the alcoholic situation or an addictive system is so overwhelming. It's not something that someone can manage on their own. And I think a lot of us who qualify for Al-Anon have been trying to manage it on our own. And it's too big of a burden to carry. And we're so reluctant sometimes, I think, to ask for help because we're afraid, at least for me, that it's going to reflect poorly on us. And what we don't realize is that, you know, this is a disease that we're talking about. And so much of what I experienced, I learned, you know, wasn't personal. An addict was just doing what addicts do.
Well said.
That was really something that set me free from some of the turmoil that I was experiencing.
Got a comment on that, George?
Well, I have a question. And I've often wondered, being on the other side of this, that when we get sober, everybody gives us, you know, slaps on the back. And I know for myself, it's taken me almost 40 years to keep getting better as a person. You talk about peeling back the onion. But what about the person who lived with that, and then all of a sudden the other person's getting all the attaboys, and things really haven't changed that much. They're just not drinking. That's got to be fairly common, I would think.
It can be. It's sort of like there are things dormant that are yet to bloom and blossom. And I think sometimes Al-Anons can be called like the black belt of recovery for that exact reason. An addict or an alcoholic who becomes sober is a really obvious testament of change. And people around them notice because they're not using, their mood is probably better, they're getting along with people that they may have had trouble with before. And an Al-Anon is sort of under the radar. They're the ones that are still making significant effort to improve their lives and try to do things differently. And yet sometimes it's not as obvious as the addict or the alcoholic who's seeking treatment, reaching out for help. Because an Al-Anon's problems tend to be more internal. And that shift may take a little bit more time to be cultivated and to rise to the surface than others may be aware of.
Does it happen often, too, that when the person gets sober, the caretaker loses their power and position and now things have changed? And I did all these things for all these years and now it's changed and maybe I'm not needed like I was.
Mm-hmm. Some of that, I think, is a natural response to finding meaning in the role that they're in. You know, being a caretaker, yes, is a lot of responsibility, but in another way, it does create some purpose for that person. And so sometimes it can be a slap in the face almost to someone who has done all this work, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue, the addict or the alcoholic reaches out for help and changes their life. And sometimes it's like, well, did anything I do count?
Mm.
And I learned when I got into recovery that there was a difference for me between being a caring person and enabling. And I needed to recognize that in the same way that maybe an addict or an alcoholic has an ego that wants to be satisfied and may be proud or have a difficult time expressing humility and being completely honest with themselves and others, I too struggled with that. It just looks a little bit differently. And so what I needed to do in terms of my own journey is to let go of whatever role that I had previously that may have given me that sense of meaning in my life, as twisted as that may sound, and start developing a new purpose where I'm still giving love and support and encouragement to the addict or the alcoholic. But now, you know, the flavor has changed. I'm the one who's guiding my own life and trying to make some better choices for myself.
Really well said. So, really well said.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So would you two, between the two of you, talk about...
You?
No, I don't want you to talk about me. I want to talk about Al-Anon and codependency. And dumb it down so I can understand it.
Go ahead.
To me, a really simple explanation of an Al-Anon, you know, or a codependent person or codependent traits would be not being addicted to the substance, but being addicted to the person who's using the substance. And trying to employ all the same tactics that the substance user would employ, like trying to control the use, but now trying to control another person and needing someone else to be okay before I'm okay. And that's how codependency really showed up in my life. I couldn't be okay unless everyone in my family was okay. And since that never happened, I always felt uneasy until I could get to a point where I could create some spiritual distance, some space between us. We call it detaching with love, and find out that I have my own needs and my own interests and my own passions, and that I can pursue those things even if those I love are not exactly in the place that I want them to be.
That takes courage. That takes a lot of courage because there's a lot at risk, isn't there?
It is, yeah.
You know, whether it's real or just in your head, there's a lot at risk because you can say, I'm lovingly detaching, and that comes at some price, doesn't it?
It does. And I mean, sometimes that means that something tragic, you know, may happen.
Mm-hmm.
And however, I mean, in my life, I think that the worst case scenario, the catastrophes that I had stored up in my brain for each and every one of my families have never come to fruition.
Interesting.
If anything, they're doing better than I thought they would be doing.
Yeah. That's interesting how you start to project what the outcome may be, and that may not be the outcome at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think for most people who do change their life with the help of Jesus, they're amazed that it's nothing at all like they thought it would be. It's totally different. But you get there when you're desperate enough to what you're doing's not working, and to not do anything about it isn't working either, so you do it. And that's when the miracles start. And they are miracles every time.
I believe so too.
Mm-hmm.
And I have come to recognize small miracles in my life so much more than I ever had before recovery. And that's when I really start to get a sense of, oh, God's hand is on my back, gently guiding me through this life. And one of my favorite recovery practices is to email a gratitude list to some of my other buddies in the program. And it's, I don't know, 12 items, typically one for each step, I guess. And I send it out to these few trusted confidants, and sometimes they send their list back and there's no expectations to respond. But it has opened my eyes so much to the goodness that's in my life, to God's work and power, and has improved, you know, my satisfaction with my own life. And it's anything big or small, and I do that on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Alexa, I'm sure you have a story. Of course, names would be inappropriate, but people that you've been able to come alongside with and encourage in a significant way.
Yes. I have a friend from high school, actually I think we met in middle school, who has lived with addict parents her whole life. And, you know, we had a little bit of a falling out in our early adulthood, but have come back and have maintained a really strong friendship. And through that particular relationship, I'm able to say to her, yeah, I know each of your parents, and I know some of the things that they've said and done, and you're not alone in that. Mm-hmm. And I go back to where I'm from in the Midwest and visit her, and I'm able to give that same support and encouragement sitting around her island in her kitchen with her two little kids running around. And she's able to receive it because of the history that we've had together and the way that she trusts me. And I think that it's a really special bond that we have, that we can share in not only the really dark and ugly kind of parts of our lives, but then that we can also share in the hope that we find.
There's something so powerful about friends you've had and known for your whole life, for a long, long time. You can't fool them, and you know what they're going through. You have an audience with them.
Yeah, and this is based on attraction rather than promotion, that people see what you're doing. And God's going to bring people in your zone that hear you and see you. People saw us when we were acting out or weren't acting out or whatever. And God's all over this. And if you do the work, Jesus said you have to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily. There's people that will see that and go, how'd you do it? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how to do this, but I see you're doing it. You got that purpose, and you realize, yeah, God is doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Mm-hmm. Beautiful story.
Mm-hmm. Alexa, I'd love for you to share with listeners tonight just the little bit of encouragement, that baby step they might need, because they've been suffering quietly and they've been at a point of maybe feeling desperation, and they are scared to open up the book and find that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to do something.
Yeah, you probably do have to do something, because the way that things have been can't go on much longer. And I think you have lots of choices. I mean, one would be to call the Al-Anon service number and speak with a live operator, someone who's also in recovery and volunteers their time, and will explain to you what Al-Anon's all about and why it may be helpful for you in your current situation. And that, of course, is anonymous as well. You know, another thing that I think could be helpful is picking up a book from the Al-Anon World Service Center. They have books available online that are published by Al-Anon, and they're on Amazon. They're on all different kinds of platforms, and you can buy those and start with a daily reader. Pick up a meditation book and read a couple paragraphs each day and start to understand what's really going on when addiction is present.
Mm-hmm.
And the many choices that are available to you.
Yeah. Well, George, another award-winning episode of Real Recovery.
Great show. Thank you for doing
Alexa,
it.
Alexa, thank you so much for being our guest.
You're welcome.
Yeah. That wraps up our show for the evening. Thanks for listening and supporting Faith Radio. George and I love you, and we'll see you next week.
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can?
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.